Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.
You'll be the best, and you got to pay a little price. You want it bad enough, you gotta do a little extra things to get it.
This podcast is brought to you by DirecTV Stream. Get your TV together with the best of live and on demand. Learn more at directtv.com. Welcome to the 11 Personnel Podcast, your favorite Rams podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Rodrigue, and with me, as always, my fabulous co-host, Rich Hammond. Rich.
Jordan, it's Friday. I was going to put a little note here on my computer
Monday.
To remind myself. It's Friday. It's not Monday. So we are coming back with everybody for a second time this week. And, of course, after a very interesting Rams victory over the Seattle Seahawks, there's a lot of different things that we can discuss. And I'm sure we'll try to put our finger on some of the big... Jordan just gave me a face on Zoom. But Jordan, how was your trip, first of all, up to Seattle? And I hear you ran into somebody on your way up to Seattle who knows us.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Let's start this podcast out in a fabulous way, honestly. Shout out to Rams fan, Canadian, kind person, Isaac, who I sat next to on the plane ride up to Seattle. And he was wearing a Rams hoodie, and I asked him if he was going to the game, and he said yes. And then he asked me if I was going to the game, and I said yes. And he said, "Are you a Rams fan?" And I said no, because obviously you guys know, you listen, if we're not supposed to have teams as reporters, we're supposed to be unbiased. He asked if I was a Seahawks fan. I said no.
It's like 20 questions.
So then you have to explain. So I said I was a journalist, and he asked who I worked for. I said The Athletic, and he was wearing a mask like we all were, but I sort of saw his face light up, and he's like, what's your name? And I said Jordan, and he pulls out his phone, and he shows me the 11 Personnel Podcast queued up on his phone. You guys, it was like the best thing in the world. And Isaac, I wanted to shout you out for not only being an excellent person to talk to on that plane ride, but also for being generally extremely pleasant. You were very respectful of my space. You gave me the armrest.
Oh, wow. That's a winner right there.
Yeah. And I just appreciated it. Like, we had a great conversation. Talked a little Rams. It just was cool. Like, that stuff, you know, when it happens, it's just like, you never know. You're like, oh, am I going to be stuck on the plane with somebody who's going to, you know, what's going to happen now? But total gentleman, awesome, awesome person. He is Canadian, and he got into football back several years ago, and he picked up the Rams because they were so fun to watch at the time, back in 2017. And he was going on a trip between the Arizona game and the Seattle game. So he was kind of taking himself on a little stadium tour and saw SoFi for the first time, had wonderful things to say about that. And it just was cool. It was so cool. He said that we are his favorite podcast. Wow. And he referenced the great discount line. So you guys, like, new favorite person on the planet, besides you, of course, Rich. And we also agreed that Rich should be narrating children's books, by the way, with that voice.
No, cool.
With that voice. So, Isaac, shout out to you. You're probably listening to this. So hell yeah, man. That was great. That was so cool. And I just wanted you guys to – I texted Rich. I took a picture of him because he was holding up his phone. I know. I'm so weird. But he was holding up his phone, and the podcast – widget was like queued up, and I was like, oh my god, it was our latest episode, the Arizona loss episode, and I was like, oh my god, and so I sent it to Rich, and I was like, Rich, it's happening, we found a fan. So that was really cool.
That is so awesome. So thank you, Isaac, and happy Thanksgiving. It's if you're Canadian, this is Thanksgiving weekend. So happy Thanksgiving, and glad that you got to enjoy a nice road trip. Having made road trips like those myself in college and with my college team, I know if it doesn't go well, it's not a good trip. So hopefully everything went well in Lumen Stadium, and the trip was good. But glad your trip went well too, Jordan. Interesting game, right? I mean, I know we're going to break it down. 26-17 victory to improve the Rams to 4-1. You can't ask for a whole lot more than that. It was another one of those weird Thursday night games. A lot of them are weird, so I know we'll get into that some. But Jordan, part of the weirdness was guys leaving the game. Some of them were able to come back. Matthew Stafford obviously able to keep playing. Tyler Higbee came back. Even Daryl Henderson looked like he was having a little bit of an issue at times, and obviously came back and finished the game strong. But a couple other injuries that might have some longer lasting impact. So what did we find out, Jordan, after the game and 24 hours later?
We found out very little, Rich.
Shocking.
As to be expected. However, Matthew was pretty forthcoming about what happened. I don't think, when I say forthcoming, I don't think he's ever going to ever admit, you know, whether he's in any pain, if he's dealing with anything. But in terms of the finger, happened in the second quarter, he said, felt like he described it as feeling some pressure on the finger. And he said he thought it was after a snap or a handoff. And then he looked down and it was like out of place. But only a little, he said. Only a little out of place. So it wasn't, okay. Yeah. So, okay, sure, man. So he pops it back in, and then obviously they go get that looked at. And the statistics from the first to the second half would demonstrate that it did not affect him much in terms of the pretty complete turnaround that they made between the first half and the second half. But something to watch for sure. Sean McVay spoke to reporters 1 p.m. This is a Friday that we are recording. Hit the Seattle airport at 4:45 a.m. Hit the Sean McVay presser at about 1 p.m. Feeling good, feeling caffeinated. He indicated that he is not concerned about this situation with Matthew Stafford. I also want to note, too, I made a point to ask Sean about some of those passes that are being underthrown, some of the ones that were sailing on him. We're going to get to it when we break down the offense a little bit more. But some of the passes are off, and you would wonder about whether something's going on maybe with his hand and the surgically repaired thumb. It's hard to really gauge that because he goes out and he lights it up after missing a bunch of throws. And so then you're like, well, is he just taking a minute to settle into some of these big stage games? Or do we think something's actually going on? And Sean McVay said he wasn't aware of anything that was going on, if that were indeed the case. So, you know, take that with a grain of salt, I think. But also that's something to continue to sort of monitor with Matthew, not just this finger, but sort of a holistic vision of how he's doing and what's going on here. Because there are some kinks to work out still, clearly, which we'll get to in a minute. But one of the big things, and real quick, just to run down the list of guys who are okay – Leonard Floyd looked like he got hurt at the end of the game. According to McVay, he did not. He's fine. And McVay said, quote, he gave me a heart attack, but he's fine. I guess he just kind of laid there an extra second on the ground. And Tyler Higbee, who suffered what looked like a fairly serious shoulder injury and was in apparent pain as I viewed through my binoculars from up in the press box on the sideline in the second quarter, came back, caught a 13-yard touchdown pass, really grinded out a really solid game, particularly as a blocker as well. Sean McVay said he's going to be okay. The guys have about 10 days off now, and the CBA dictates they've got the next 3 days off. So they'll have some time to rest up and repair a little bit. The big question that we're going to also need to continue to monitor is starting cornerback Darius Williams. Outstanding player, really dependable guy. The Rams certainly depend on him and have for the last year. And he sprained his ankle late in the game. Sean McVay described it as a mild ankle sprain. Couldn't foresee Darius whether he will miss time or how much that time could be. Because it sounds to me like, because we've talked about ankles being a little bit of a fickle injury zone, it sounds to me like they're going to see how he comes back in this next week when guys can come, you know, come back in and actually are, you know, eligible for practice again. I'm going to see how that sort of shakes out, and we'll kind of probably get daily updates on that situation next week. But interestingly, some of the personnel shifted around. David Long, who had essentially been benched for Robert Rochelle after a rough outing against Arizona on Sunday, rookie corner Robert Rochelle came in. When Darius left the game, they actually kept Jalen Ramsey on the outside and they played David Long in the slot, where David Long had not played any snaps, zero snaps through the season and also through training camp and the preseason. So that's, we're going to see how that whole personnel package shifts around if Darius does have to miss time. If not, sounds like Robert Rochelle will still be starting on the outside based on the rather poetic soliloquy Sean McVay went on when talking about Robert Rochelle. And also, I tweeted out a link to my deep dive on how they scouted Robert Rochelle. It's some fascinating stuff in there about him as a prospect, him as a person. It's a really good, cool blend of data and player evaluation and old fashioned, you know, scouting. And it just, I really enjoyed reporting it through. So go check that out. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see the way this secondary changes. And also, Rich asked the Terrell Burgess question. Will we see his role expand? I asked Sean McVay that, and he indicated that they aren't set where they are. Like, he indicated that things could continue to expand. He spoke highly of Terrell Burgess. He said he believes in him, and indicated he'd like to get him on the field. So we're really going to see how everything shakes out. They've got some time to reevaluate here, and I think they have to. This defense, I mean, it shows flashes of a lot of its potential, but giving up a lot of yards, man, and the explosive plays just keep coming.
Yeah, we will see what happens there with Darius Williams, and yeah, the extra time off here, ankle sprains. I mean, you never know. It can be a couple days and he's back on his feet, or it could be 2-3 weeks. It just really depends on how the severity of it and how quickly he's able to get back on the field. But yeah, Jordan, I feel like even if Darius hadn't gotten hurt in that game, we'd still be having some form of this conversation, because I think we've been having it over the last couple weeks just about this Rams secondary. And you've written about it so extensively and so well at The Athletic, where you can always find Jordan's stories on our app, on our website, including the most recent, The Pile, which went up last night. Great read on the Rams' victory over the Seahawks. But we've talked a lot about Jalen Ramsey, and I know we're going to get into Jalen a little bit more specifically individually, but just about how that complement works. If you put Jalen in a certain role, then you need some help. You need some people you can rely on, and it seems like that's a little bit of a work in progress for the Rams. Look, bottom line, they won the game. They gave up 16 points. But again, you mentioned those explosive plays, Jordan, and I looked this up the other day. I didn't tweet it out because I felt like I'd been tweeting a lot of negative stuff. I know that's so unlike me, but I held this one back. But and part of the tweet that I was going to put out was started with the caveat that raw numbers can be dangerous. That was actually the first thing that I wrote. But last season, the Rams allowed 36 pass plays of 20 plus yards all season. That was the fewest in the NFL. This season, I believe, I'm really bad at math, but I believe I did this correctly. They've already allowed 18 in 5 games. So they're already half of what they were last year in terms of those 20 plus. I didn't look at the 40 plus. They were first in the league last year at that too. I don't think there was a 40 yesterday. So that probably comes down. The average comes down.
Well, there was, but it was by penalty, which the receiver doesn't get credit for. So
50 some yard pass interference. Yeah. Yeah. So that you know, basically is a 50 yard pass. I mean, it's just, you just get it one way rather than the other. Yeah. So, we've talked about these almost ad nauseum over the first, you know, few weeks of the season here. But so what do you think, Jordan? I mean, what, and maybe we can get into the Jalen stuff that we were going to talk about here. But if you're the Rams, if you're Sean McVay, if you're Raheem Morris, you've got some time now to think about this. You've got 10 days before the next game. Let's even say Darius is healthy. He's able to play. Do you take a different look at this now? I mean, do these results, do some of these explosive plays change the way that you approach this, or do you at least have to take a look at it?
I think for me, one of the things that I would expect to continue to be the case is that Robert Rochelle does continue to start on the outside, and Darius Williams, if he's healthy, which, as of now, we're working on optimism and not much information, right? But let's kind of just go with that and assume that for the majority rest of the stretch of the season, Darius will be healthy, right? I think that part of the issue that they were having, and in particular with some of these matchups, a lot of these explosive plays to me, I think back to the one against the first one I really remember seeing, which was in the air, which was the play action bite off of Carson Wentz against Indianapolis. That's an execution error. You're not supposed to, the way that the safeties are supposed to play visually, and I think that was a safeties issue as well. The way the safeties are supposed to play visually, you're not supposed to bite, and they're playing from death. You're not supposed to bite on the play action in that regard. And I think of some of the things, the ones that I've seen that I can remember that really were costly, multiple that came on drives. There's a couple of guys who work for they created a club at University of Michigan called Michigan Analytics, and they do football analytics. A bunch of them work for PFF. And one of these guys, he found that when you have two or more explosive plays, let me see if I can recall this correctly. I shared it out the other day. One or more explosive play on a drive, one explosive play on a drive triples the probability that the team will score. So that's why Brandon Staley was so adamant, and still is so adamant, on first and foremost defending the explosive passing plays. It's much more likely to suffer a backbreaking explosive passing play just by the nature of the ball traveling through the air, or the penalties that happen, or just things like that. And I think that's still philosophically what this defense has to be about. But execution-wise, I just hadn't seen it happening. And I also think that it was disadvantageous to some of the matchups that they had to have. To have certain, certain guys matched up in certain places. I'm not trying to pick on David Long, because he is having, I think, a rough couple of weeks. Seems to be handling it well. He's a great guy, so it seems to be handling it in a positive way, and hopefully, you hope that he responds from it. And the Raheem Morris spoke highly of him, despite the fact that he did directly call him out in his press conference last week, and that kind of pointed us to thinking Robert Rochelle would start. That's just on the outside like that. When you are dependent on overhang corners, especially if you're moving Jalen Ramsey around to have a greater effect on the ball on every snap, when you are dependent on overhang corners, they have to have some length to them. And in Darius Williams' case, he's not exactly like a lengthy frame guy, but he makes plays on the ball. And so you're comfortable putting him on the outside or rotating him into the slot, which sort of unlocks what Jalen Ramsey can do when he does move back outside. And he doesn't keep – it means that Jalen Ramsey doesn't get stuck in the slot, because as I've explained, until I am out of breath and falling off my chair – The star does not mean you are always the slot player. It means that when it is most advantageous for you to affect the game against a receiver who's aligned inside, a prolific number one tight end who's aligned inside, when it's most advantageous for you to affect the run game, that is when you are aligned closer to the line of scrimmage. It doesn't mean you need to stay there or should stay there or will stay there. And we'll get to some of those numbers in a minute. It also means that you need to be really good schematically at picking your spots in which you rotate him back outside, which against Arizona, at least three crucial passing downs, two third downs and a second down, All forced incompletions by Jalen Ramsey. Still playing, you know, freshly outwardly aligned outside of the star, once in the star. And you saw that movement a lot. But the problem becomes when you have a mismatch on the outside, on the overhang, where you have a mismatch in terms of a 6'4 receiver against a 5'10 corner who doesn't necessarily have a huge history of making plays on the ball as a professional player. And also I brought this up on the Seahawks Man to Man podcast, and you also have put that on tape. Like, that Cowboys practice was broadcast live on Cowboys.com, and the Cowboys threw every receiver over 6 feet outside on David Long. I mean, Cliff Kingsbury had to have seen that. I would bet money that he saw that, and they started planning from that point, because they knew they had multiple 6 feet plus receivers. Jalen Ramsey's going to guard one. You're going to have to put Darius on maybe your slot guy, or you switch him around and Darius is on DeAndre, or Darius is on AJ Green, and then Jalen's on your other prolific guy. And you have to, like, but the offense can scheme around stuff too. And when you have two tall receivers like that, and you can also, you're getting not pressured very much, and your quarterback can pick his spots, then you're going to go over the top of David Long. And that's, so to me, this is a very sideways way of me making my point and saying Robert Rochelle has length of frame. He has explosiveness. His athletic profile that they found, matched those things actually very closely to that of Jalen Ramsey's. He's got really, really long arms. And Sean McVay talked about this extensively when I asked him about exactly how that corresponds to what he can do. He pointed to that last pass breakup that Robert Rochelle had, where he basically used the back of his hand and his fingertips to break up a pass intended for Tyler Lockett in the end zone and prevented a touchdown in an adverse situation in which Darius Williams had left the field. And, you know, he gave up a couple of big plays, including that pass interference that we mentioned, and he did give up a touchdown as well, or was the closest defender to that touchdown. But also, like, what was going to happen? He was a rookie in his first game. Like, in a hostile environment, he's out of a small school after a week of scout team snaps. I mean, Rich, I saw some of the comments that people were making about him, and my heart went out to him. And that doesn't excuse it. Those comments shouldn't be made about David Long either. But in terms of this, like, I saw some people just being like ruling Robert Rochelle out, like, as a player based on his, you know, and then he comes back. And the thing that these Rams players were talking about post game was how even keeled he was and how balanced he stayed and how, like, he was just good to go. And I say this phrase so much now this year, but, like, you could see him problem solving and putting things together in real time down there to the point where he stacked enough blocks to make that play at the end. And that was a crucial play for them. So I think, like, that seeing that and also the way he carried himself, I think Robert Rochelle is a long way of me saying, I think Robert Rochelle will be starting for them in the future and continuing to be their sort of test run guy there. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that he just offers a better matchup against teams that try to scheme taller receivers to the outside. And if you've got Jalen on the outside and you're forcing more difficult throws outside the numbers, which is part of the plan for Jalen, you're trying to turn the quarterback's window away from Jalen into as small of a sliver as possible to then increase and compound the difficulty of that throw that he has to make, then you also want to make sure that you make it even more difficult by putting a guy who at least can, you know, kind of have that length on the outside and that explosiveness and the athleticism to contest some of those things should the quarterback find them. And I think that's kind of the direction that you kind of saw them start to trend, particularly against Seattle. The explosives, I know, it doesn't, you know, they're, I don't even know what to say about them at this point, because if you allow an offense to get behind you in the passing game against this defense, like we've talked about, it's a foundational principle that's this defense is, philosophically built and predicated off of stopping the explosive past first and foremost. So something is very wrong if you're not able to do that. And we've just talked about this ad nauseum at this point. So little things like this make me believe, hey, maybe it's going to be fixed, or at least trying things to try to fix it. They're not concrete in where they're at right now.
Yeah.
I went on a lot of tangents in one rant, Rich, but
no, but it all of this is so important when you talk about this defense and I mean they look and talk about Robert Rochelle too. I mean you're five games into a season and you're playing the Seattle Seahawks and Russell Wilson and DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett and this team that seems like it's been together forever. So I would just caution people. Yeah, you know it's not like you excuse things or say, oh, you had a good game. Like you can look at the good and the bad, but it's like anything else. You have to put it in some context. Like you have to look at what he's doing and not everybody is Jalen Ramsey, by the way. Jalen Ramsey was not Jalen Ramsey five games into his NFL season, I'm pretty sure. So you have to take these things with a little bit of a grain of salt. But it's fascinating to see. And I know, Jordan, how you've invested so much time and your resources into understanding all of this and putting the pieces together. Because, I mean, you talk about, you know, jumping around to different things. There are a lot of different parts to this defense.
Yeah, there
are.
And
a lot of different things that you have to understand and how they impact each other and how one player impacts the other. And you know, there's just a lot here. And I would expect to see that evolve. It's interesting to look ahead. I mean, you look at the next three games. I mean, it's the Giants, it's the Lions, it's the Texans. And you go, wow, that's a little bit of a different challenge. I'm not going to say better or worse, but it's a little bit different of a challenge than looking back at the last three games where you say Russell Wilson and the Seahawks, Kyler Murray and the Cardinals, Tom Brady and the Buccaneers. I mean, that is quite a three-game little gauntlet there in terms of facing quarterbacks. Now, we'll see what happens. As I said, we're recording this on Friday. So the New York Giants will play on Sunday against Dallas. Daniel Jones, been pretty good for the first few games of the season. Not great, not all pro, but certainly better than what we saw last year when he was on my fantasy team, by the way, and ruined my fantasy
team. I was going to ask. I said, I know where this is going.
Yeah. So Daniel Jones and the Giants, and then, of course, Jared Goff and the Lions. We'll have a lot to say about that next week. And the Texans. So entering and even looking after that, the Titans. I mean, so looking ahead, it's a little bit of a different challenge than what the Rams have faced over the last few weeks. And I would expect these things to continue to evolve. We spent a lot of time last week talking about the defense, Jordan, and how it was just kind of an across-the-board failure. I mean, that was a terrible defensive game against Arizona. And you look at this game, they did, I think, a commendable job in run defense. Alex Collins, they obviously didn't have Chris Carson. It seems to me like Chris Carson misses like every Rams Seahawks game. I don't know what it is. I mean, the guy gets hurt a lot, so maybe that's part of it. But Alex Collins comes in 15 carries for 47 yards. You know, he didn't do really anything to impact the game. He didn't change the game. So I thought they did a pretty good job there. And you know, they were able to contain for the most part. Geno Smith came in. We didn't talk about that. I mean,
God, what an implosion of
Holy
the Rams
cow.
Defense on that drive.
Holy
also,
cow. But Jordan, not to throw back the secondary on you again, but I know you had some interesting stuff about
yes,
Jalen Ramsey.
And I got on a tangent. Again.
Yeah. No, please go back into that.
As
no, because it's
to
really
do.
Interesting. Yeah, and it's important to what we're talking about here, right?
Yeah, and Rich, thanks for bringing me back to planet Earth here, because how I get going. You get me talking about defense, and God only knows where we're going to end up at that point. So I can always count on you to sort of bring me back to Earth on that one. But so what I was talking about in terms of the pieces and the moving pieces of these things, and each one sort of being so dependent on another, and one phase of this plan, which is, in my opinion, a great plan, which is to move Jalen Ramsey around the field like a master chess piece, with near autonomy and pick your spots. And you have to also pick the right spots, by the way. And I won't say that they've been perfect at picking the right spots, but I think that the plan has been, you know, for him, I see the vision of that plan. And I think it's a really good plan where you pick the spots where you believe he will most affect the play on every play, not just passing downs, because he can move, because he's so good in run support. I mean, some of the tackles this guy makes, it's like he's an outside linebacker. You can move him now to affect a higher percentage of the plays because you're also moving him as that chess piece and you're realigning him. You're shrinking the viable windows in which a quarterback has on the other side of the ball to throw. So whereas before, quarterbacks could add a mathematical advantage by throwing to a viable receiver away from the number one who was covered by the shutdown corner, by the number one corner. It doesn't work like that anymore. You're spreading the field out. You're distributing the ball, and shutdown corners on one side isolated snap after snap after snap. It just doesn't happen anymore because the quarterback can then avoid that entire section of the field and use every inch of every other space. So by moving Jalen Ramsey around, you're shrinking the area. I always talk about solar systems. You're shrinking the space, the orbital space in which the quarterback can actually put the football. And you're making life really hard because no quarterback wants to throw at Jalen Ramsey. But his numbers show that they have to now at a higher rate. Now, I will say Thursday night was not his best game. He gave up a touchdown. It looks like Next Gen Stats has him 5 catches, 61 yards, and a touchdown that he gave up. Gave up his longest pass of the year when aligned opposite of DK Metcalf in coverage, 25 yards. Allowed DK Metcalf's first touchdown against him. But still, I believe that was – he still only had something like, 44 yards allowed and a touchdown to DK Metcalf, 2 catches. Still not terrible, right? You don't want the touchdown, but not terrible. Overall, Next Gen has him at 8 targets. That's a team high. So not only could you not avoid Jalen Ramsey, you couldn't avoid him at an all-time at a high over any other corner on the roster. That's a good plan to make him unavoidable, to make him inevitable.
Right.
That is the plan. And I will say, and this falls on Raheem Morris, this is a Jonathan Cooley thing, this is a Jiro Evero thing, picking his spots are really important. It requires, schematic, getting the opponent's tells and tendencies and a lot of work behind the scenes and figuring out exactly where to put him based on certain tells, certain tendencies, where they think the passing play is going to go. It also really helps the situation when you can affect the quarterback. So he's not picking the spots he wants to throw the ball. The Rams' pressure rate has not been good over the last couple of weeks, and they're inconsistent. There's some players starting to come along. We'll get to them in a minute, but just not consistent pressure over the last couple of weeks. So, you don't want the quarterback to be able to pick the spots, but overall you are making him unavoidable. That's the point. It doesn't mean that he's
right
in the slot just hanging out. It means that you are aligning him in the space where you believe he will be most unavoidable by the quarterback. And in that way, drastically flipping that mathematical advantage that quarterbacks have by nature of having, multiple receivers on the field that they can throw to, by nature of, previously just being able to go to someone else other than that corner. Now the other problem becomes you don't want the other players the quarterback could then go to be giving up big passing plays. So right, that therein lies the other problem. So that's my Jalen Ramsey rant. The mini rant. If you guys want the full rant, there's about 35 minutes of it over on the Seahawks Man to Man podcast from last week because I went on a little bit of a tear there. So
that's
cheers.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we love those guys too. They do an awesome job. So yeah, go check them out too. See, get what their take on all of this is too. I'm sure they have some interesting thoughts on how the Seahawks tried to attack the Rams defense. Very interesting game for Jalen. And of course, he, you know, he is also all over that interception by Troy Reader and deflecting that, popping that up in the air. And Troy makes a nice play on the ball to intercept it, to keep it at 0-0 early in the second quarter there. So that was an important one. So, yeah, interesting. You know, we want to pivot to the offense, too. But just one other guy I wanted to shout out, Terrell Lewis. And, you know, another guy we've been talking a lot about since the preseason. Well, really, since the offseason. And you look at the raw numbers. I mean, he didn't pop off the sheet. I think he only had three or four tackles in the game, but just super involved in everything. And interesting to me, he played 63% of the snaps. Yeah, I don't know about you, Jordan. I'm still kind of in a hold your breath, you know, with Terrell Lewis. You know, when he gets to the end of the game and everything seems to be okay, it feels like a victory. So I mean, first of all, what are you seeing there from him as he continues to develop? And also, do you think the Rams, let me put it this way, do you think the Rams are tempted at all to keep pushing that gas pedal, just knowing how well he's playing? Or are they going to be able to be kind of strict or stay on the plan with that sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, so I think that they will continue to be careful with that and be strict with it. I think if you see him play expanded snaps, it's not necessarily because they're just winging it in the moment. They're so strategic with some of their sports science and some of their recovery science, which they keep very quiet, by the way. And it's fascinating to try to dig a little bit on some of the process stuff that they do and some of the really, really smart recovery stuff that they do. But it's kind of the same thing when we talk about like Daryl Henderson having a magic number or like a count where they think it will maximize his output while also keeping him available. It's the same thing with Terrell Lewis. What numbers of snaps and what sort of workload can you put on the affected area that will maximize your availability as well as your ability at the same time, and sort of where that Venn diagram meets is the money spot there. Really impressed with him. I just, you know, you and I have been talking about this guy for the last year and a half in terms of we know what he's capable of if, right? And he's starting to put it together and it's really great. We talked to Leonard Floyd earlier in the week and like, oh my goodness, it's the most endearing thing in the world to see Leonard Floyd just light up talking about Terrell Lewis. Aaron Donald lighting up, talking about Terrell Lewis. Aaron Donald mentioned something that I thought was really interesting in that Terrell Lewis, it's kind of what we talked about with Robert Shell. Terrell Lewis will adjust the different types of ways that he's trying to assert in the game. Not just, if certain facets of the pass rush aren't working, he's trying to stick a hand in throwing lanes. He's trying to continue to improve even in in-game situations. I think that shows a level of maturity as a player and a growth capacity as a player when you're not just in there up to your ears and just like sort of treading water wide-eyed and just trying to like stay afloat and just like every play is it's just like a whirlwind. Instead, you're looking around and you're choosing your moments and you're choosing, you know, how you can improve and you're choosing the different ways where you can sort of troubleshoot and fix tendencies. And I think that's what I see with Terrell Lewis. Big day for him. That was a huge sack for a loss of 12 yards. Really, yeah. Really needed it. After that, you know, Matthew Stafford started to find some momentum and really started to try to turn what was an extremely ugly first half. Like, oh my goodness, it was a gross first half. and that first half of football and Russell Wilson's finger, I mean, you talk about gross. The poor guy. You feel for him. That thing, they kept showing it on the broadcast. I don't understand why they do that. but it just, you could feel Matthew Stafford sort of and the offense sort of gather themselves after that big splash play and start to try to flip things over, and it started working.
Yeah, thank you for that great transition there. It's exactly what one of the things that I had written down, because you know what we're talking about here is the Rams. I mean, I don't know how much we want to say about that first half. It was out of sync in pretty much every area, but they're able to go into it down only 7-3, so it wasn't out of reach. But the Seahawks got the ball to start the second half, so that was a very important drive, and they seemed to be moving a little bit. They got the ball to midfield, and then on 2nd and 10, Terrell Lewis comes up with a big sack, loss of 12, and the Seahawks punt, and the Rams come back with a very pass-heavy drive. Which fine, it ended up working out.
He says, his voice dripping with a certain quality of sarcasm there.
Yes, a little bit. But here's the play that I think everybody's going to want to talk about here. And it's an interesting play on a number of fronts because the Rams got the ball back there. Now, what's probably going to be forgotten in a little bit of this is that they didn't move the ball particularly well when they got it back. It was 3rd and 10 from their own 20. And Matthew Stafford drops back. DeSean Jackson taking a nice leisurely run through the middle of the secondary, which didn't seem to pay much attention to the ball. Matthew Stafford actually underthrows this ball quite a bit to DeSean Jackson, who does a great job of locating it and adjusting to it and making the catch and turning it into what ended up being a 68 yard catch and run that really just turned the tide, Jordan. It felt to me like that was the play. You were obviously there at the stadium. I know in Seattle you sit behind a glass booth there, so it's kind of hard to judge sometimes, but it felt like that was the play that kind of turned the tide.
Yeah, and it goes back to what we're talking about, literally why this Rams defense wants and needs to contain these specific types of plays. They break your back. You know, it's like when Bane lifts Batman up in the air. You know what I mean? Like, it's such a momentum, and like momentum isn't qualitatively real in football. It's more of an emotion in football. But at the same time, the way that you can quantify those incredibly important explosive plays and the when they happen and the, you know, the quarterback sort of settling in once something like that connects. All of those things, very, very important. And that was, and it should not be understated, DeSean Jackson played that pass extremely smartly and sort of came back. We said on the last podcast, my personal plan would just be throw it the hell downfield as far as you can for DeSean Jackson and understand that he will probably position himself under it because he is still very, very fast. But at the same time, we did get kind of a peek into some of the whys behind a little bit of those underthrows. And the first one against Arizona, that was, of course, intercepted. Matthew Stafford said that he picked the wrong throw in terms of the over versus the under. And because he thought that Byron Murphy was coming over the top. Well, in this last one, if you will see, and I'm not excusing an underthrow at all, let me be clear on that. But you will see that I believe it was Jamal Adams was certainly coming over the top on that. And so if it was on purpose, which these guys are, you know, the best in the world at what they do, but I still am not willing to say that it was completely on purpose. I think it depends on who you ask, probably. But if it was at least intended to be slightly to where it wasn't coming directly over the top, where Jamal Adams would have been able to not only make the play on the ball, but it be in perfect position for the receiver, then to not be able to make sort of that reverse pass breakup situation happen or make the tackle if there was an interception. He was coming over the top, and DeSean Jackson helped it along like so well because he sort of stutter stepped underneath as he was tracking the ball and perfectly positioned himself to make the catch and then ended up getting several extra yards after the catch as well. And that was just so important. And, you know, it really was just such a tale of two things because, you know, the Rams were at first, the first half, 4.8 yards per play, you know, a field goal, you know, a touchdown, lots of punting, scoreless on their opening drives again, you know, held without touchdowns on their opening drives, you know, barely squeaking through, getting off the field too quickly in some cases. And then ultimately after that pass starts to click and they start to click into place and they start to get things going and execute. Robert Woods obviously having a huge part in the way that they were able to execute and manipulate some of those contours, that cover three that we keep seeing Seattle go back to, that there is a literal playbook for how to destroy that. And the Rams utilized it. And you know, they just started to assert themselves a lot better, and particularly after the ultimate assertion, which is a play like that. And it was really important. The second half, they upped their average. It's really hard to like lift that average right? You have to be way over to lift it over 3.3 average yards per play, which they did. They went to 7.7 yards per play by the end of the game. Not just to neutralize the average, but to lift the average, like that takes a little bit of an effort there. They looked a lot more like what they should look like at the end, and particularly in some of those tempo drives that they exercised. Wasn't just the 96 play, or excuse me, I keep saying that, the 96 plays. My God, that'd be something else. Yeah. The 96 yard drive. It's not just that. It's also, some of the ways where they picked their tempo, some of the way they tried to score very quickly when Russell Wilson was getting his finger looked at on the sideline. Hopefully that didn't go unnoticed by people. They were trying to capitalize on, maybe four. It backfired on them, of course, because, Geno Smith came in and scored, but on a 98 yard drive. But, trying to push the pace of that scoring drive so that you could keep Russell Wilson off the field if he wasn't fully through the check process with the medical staff. Just things like that, where they just started to try to assert themselves in various ways, and they started successfully doing that. And it all starts with something like that. It might not always be the big play. It sort of feels like the Rams are forcing it to try to be that big play that gets things rolling for them every time. And maybe we'll see that change a little bit, but it's also the things that just start to click, those back-to-back 20-yard plays by Robert Woods and scheming guys open on our Ted Wynn had a great series on the same play, literally the same passing play against that cover three, like multiple times through the second half, just things like that, that help you feel like you're asserting your plan, that really, really helped them move forward.
Yeah, you mentioned that rhythm with Robert Woods, and those are two big on the next drive. After the Rams took that 9-7 lead, then they went forced Seattle to go three and out, and that's when that connection with Robert Woods really came through. I mean, the 2 20-yard plays, like you said, and it was funny, Jordan. Robert Woods ends up with 12 catches on 14 targets for 150 yards. So a big game. I have to say, I think it was the first play of the game. I rolled my eyes a little bit because it was clearly a forced, I think it was like a bubble screen where it's like, okay, we get it. You're going to throw the ball to Robert Woods. But then it started to make more sense. Like, I think it probably got them in a little bit of a rhythm, and they went back to him a couple times early in the game, in the first quarter, where it clearly looked like Robert Woods was the first read, and Matthew Stafford was able to get the ball to him. So it didn't pay off right away with a lot of big stuff, but it just seemed like they got more and more comfortable as the game went on, and it obviously paid off in some really big catches in the second half. Went back to a little bit more of that script that we talked about a couple weeks ago that worked. I shouldn't say script, that suggests that it was a plan, but Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp end up combining for 24 targets out of the 35. Tyler Higbee only with 2 targets, and obviously one of them was a touchdown, so that was effective. They tried to get other guys involved. They tried to get Van Jefferson going a little bit. He had one nice catch. I think there was a drop in there. There were a couple of missed throws. That really wasn't working. So they just had Woods and Kupp working, and Matthew Stafford did a good job of keeping. It wasn't like he was throwing to Robert Woods at the expense of Cooper Kupp. Cooper Kupp still had 7 catches for 92 yards and was still very involved in that offense. But it didn't look like they were forcing it. And to me, that was the difference between this week and last week. Everything that happened this week seemed like it was a little bit more in the flow and the rhythm of an offense. And then my favorite topic.
Yay, the run game. I knew we would get here.
Yeah, so interesting, Jordan, and I want to get your thoughts on this, as I think we both dissect or translate Sean McVay at times. But so Darrell Henderson, I thought, had a great game. 17 carries for 82 yards, almost 5 yards per carry, boosted by that really nice 29-yard run that also came at an important time. Now, Sony Michel ends up with 11 carries. He got put in the game, basically. I don't know whether this is by design or not. I don't know how much Sony Michel would have played otherwise, but there was a period there where Daryl Henderson went to the sideline. It looked like they were looking at his left arm, not really sure what came of that, but Sony Michel came in the game and had some nice runs there. So the split ends up being not too wide with Daryl with 17 carries and Sony with 11 carries. And Jordan, I know after the game, I think this was your question even, asking Sean McVay a little bit about that, and he suggested something interesting, which, again, this is what I want to get your thoughts on, because sometimes coaches will say things like this because they think it sounds good or because they think it's the right thing to say. He suggested that there could be a little bit more of what we saw in that game, that these guys can complement each other. Now, Jordan, do you believe that, or are we going to go back to a heavy dose of Daryl Henderson against the Giants?
Well, I believe it because I saw it. I mean, we all saw it, you know, like I think that was a really smart run game plan for them. You know, the one I absolutely hated, almost threw my computer, was the wave the white flag call on that 3rd and 10 where they ran the ball.
Weird.
On 3rd and 10. That was like the 2019, 2020. Screw it. The series is over anyways. Throwaway play. That's really the one that I didn't agree with. The other run, I mean, the run game, I loved watching that run game from up. We had a great view in that press box, a great all 22 view, but we weren't super far away. So we could see some of the intricacies of the blocks being thrown and some of the holes that were being opened up. There was a 29 yard run by Daryl Henderson. He made a gorgeous cut and Tyler Higbee threw a block for him. Like shoulder falling off of his body, Tyler Higbee like threw a block for him. And I just had to sit back in my chair. I was like, holy smokes. That was just like, my goodness. But I really liked it because then when Sony Michel would come in, you wouldn't feel that sort of jolting thing that they were sometimes when they were trying to establish a sort of committee approach with three backs, in 2020, which was just kind of felt jolty sometimes. But in this case, it almost felt seamless when they would spell each other and rotate in and out. And Sony Michel and Daryl Henderson are different runners, and you could really see that. And you could see how the defense struggled to adjust with it. Yes, we know Seattle's run defense is very poor this year. Defense as a whole is giving up record numbers of yards at this point. So you better have gotten the run game going against them, essentially. But that's not to discredit what they were able to do, because they really were working and making some nice, just picking up some nice yards. And it was interesting because, and I don't know if it's because their skill sets complement each other so well, or because they picked the right numbers for both of them and the right moments for both of them, or because the game was going the way that it was, or all three. But it felt really seamless when they would rotate in and out. And it was almost like the explosiveness of Daryl, and then you'd get a little bit of that like downhill, like power running, smooth sort of stability from, and you'd get like a flash, and then you'd get stable, and then you get a flash, and then you get stable, and you get a flash. And it was really... That was kind of the way that they were doing it. I would imagine that's very difficult for a defense to counter because you're changing so often your keys and your different things that these guys do. Running outside a lot of times with Daryl Henderson, and you saw that work effectively. And then running right down their throats with Sony Michel, and you saw that work effectively. And I think both of those guys are so steady personality-wise that it really helps them complement each other in that way. And so that's really what the goal was when they, in my opinion, and that's what I heard from people behind the scenes, is that that game, what they produced, and maybe hell, maybe a little more if they had the opportunity to do so, if they hadn't been so slow to start, essentially, more yardage, you know, that seemed like close to around Daryl's magic number that we just talked about earlier. But we know Sony can take a larger carry share, but if you don't have to, if it's working effectively and the number is right for both guys, then that's what they will do. And it's less about having a set number. I know fantasy football players, you will kill me for this and I will hear it, but it's not about the number of carries or the percentage of carries. It's about what is right in the moment and the situation. Yeah. And the fact that you have two guys who can execute situationally in that way that feels seamless, that is what becomes really important.
Do you think this is close to what we would have seen with Cam Akers and Daryl Henderson?
Yes. Or
how much do you think it would have been different?
I think this is very close to what we would have seen with Cam Akers and Daryl Henderson. I do think you'd probably see Cam Akers the lead back in a lot more cases.
Right.
But I still think you would see a compliment in that regard. And I think it's if you could make it work, it's really smart. You don't want to do it at the cost of the rhythm of your run game. Of course not. And if that's not working, you move toward one guy as a lead back. But and certainly situationally, like if power running is better option, you go with the power runner. But both types worked against Seattle's defense, right?
Yeah.
And so it was like, to me, the ability to pick your spots, it doesn't come at the detriment necessarily of someone else, because in this case, it's both guys who have dealt with an injury history and have had some issues. And so both picking these spots in this way didn't necessarily come at the detriment of each player, unless you're only in it for, fantasy football points, in which case you're like, oh man, two more carries, Daryl, dang it. Right. Which they certainly don't care about. Sorry to break it to you guys. but it maximizes availability. It takes takes the workload off of a player's body. Yeah. So that's kind of that sweet spot they're going for, especially when faced with this adverse circumstance of Cam Akers being out. You know, they hope will maximize both ability and availability.
Yeah, and that's why I liked the signing of Sony Michel. I mean, obviously the loss of Cam Akers was terrible, not for him and for the team, but there were different things that they could have done there, and I know people had a lot of different ideas about different running backs or whatever. But and I'm not saying I was a Sony Michel expert by any stretch of the imagination, but it made sense when they signed him, just because it made sense that Daryl Henderson was not going to suddenly become a 25 carry per game running back, nor was the person who they signed, whoever that was. So what you were going to be looking for is, I think, exactly what you just explained very well, Jordan, is that compliment, not only in the number of carries, but in the style, somebody who could bring something a little bit different. So I think this works, and I think it'll be interesting to track how they continue to use those guys. It's not easy, and I know I saw Sean McVay shouted out Thomas Brown, after the game last night. You have to put some thought into that. You know, how are you going to get these guys in a rhythm? You can't be predictable either when you put certain guys out there. You can't start to have tendencies that defenses can pick up on. So it's not easy. It's not easy to navigate when you've got a situation like this. But I think if the Rams can do it well, then they've really got something here. And it's going to be great to track. Jordan, speaking of the run game, which came into play here, something else, the run game near and dear to my heart, but something that I know that's always near and dear to your heart is fourth down decisions that Sean McVay made. And I genuinely want, I'm not going anywhere.
Let me pull up my chart, Richard.
Yes, please get the, because I'll set the table here, because I thought this was interesting. And when I say interesting, I'm not being snarky. I genuinely thought it was interesting. So we're talking about the same drive here late in the second quarter. The Rams are down 7-0 at the time. Let's back it up. They face a 2nd and 2 at the Seattle 24. They run it to Sony Michel for 0 yards. So 3rd and 2 from the 24, Sony Michel picks up 1 yard. So now you've got 4th and 1 from the 23. You've basically just been stuffed twice. Sean McVay decides to go for it from the Seattle 23.
Good decision.
And picks it up. Yeah. And Sony Michel picks it up with a 2 yard gain. Drive continues. They get it down to the Seattle 12. It's a 3rd and 1. They hand it off to Sony Michel again. Gets stuffed. Loss of 1. 4th and 2. From the 13, and they kick it, a 31-yard field goal. Jordan, what did I miss there? Like if I, knowing what I know of Sean McVay, I think I would look at the ball in the 23-yard line and say, okay, he's going to take the 3 points there because he doesn't want to go into halftime down 7-0 and not scoring any points. He goes for it there, but then kicks it from the 13.
Yeah.
So that was weird.
Yeah. So both are go situations, statistically speaking. Right. And what I used to help track this, two sources that I really, really trust. And if you guys aren't tracking along, you definitely should be. Ben B. Baldwin. He has created an algorithm via a Twitter bot that tracks all of the fourth down decisions made in the NFL, and it will tell you what the win probability percentage is per decision, whether it's a go situation or a kick situation or a toss up. And also, Edge Sports also sends those analytical models as well, and does a lot of that stuff live. So here we took both. Both were go situations. The second was a higher win probability plus go situation, 6.1% win probability added by going for and converting that fourth down, while the other was, the first one was a 4.5% win probability increase. Both were, again, both were go situations, but instead of the first, you know, I certainly don't think they're looking at this. Otherwise, you know, because I certainly don't think they're tracking this. But I do think that maybe they do it after the fact. But in game, I don't right. get the sense. Sean McVay is one of the most conservative coaches in the league in fourth down decision making. I certainly don't think they're tracking in game win probability increase and decrease in terms right. in terms of these specific decisions. That situation, because they converted that fourth down and one on the 23, that added 4.5% in win probability to the drive, you know, to that one drive. Mm-hmm. And then if he would have converted the other, it would have added another 6.1%, which is obviously, you know, close to 11% on one drive, which is a huge swing in your favor in terms of increasing your win probability in a single in a single sort of progression down the field. But part of it, I wondered if it might have been situational. I mean, I'm not going to give McVay the benefit of the doubt there, because he probably would not have gone for both of them anyway. But wondering if that second one was when Matthew Stafford may have gotten hurt.
I was just looking at that.
Yeah. I kind of wondered if that second one, I mean, again, if a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? If a double punt is punted and nobody's there to see it, is it doubly punted? But I really think that was maybe more of a situational decision in that regard, because you weren't sure what happened to your quarterback's hand at that point. Right. But I'm just saying, you know, that decision, both going for it on both would have been analytically sound decisions, both correct decisions to make. In that situation, one out of two is good for McVay,
right?
Because again, he is among the most conservative coaches in the entire league in those fourth down decisions. So you know, they won the game. So we're not sitting there thinking, "Oh, woulda, coulda, shoulda," and calculating by how much win probability did you ultimately dip. But going for it in both, you know. I long for the day when I see such a thing, but I just don't, you know, I don't see it happening. It's something I'm like trying to work on in terms of having that conversation. I doubt that's a conversation that most coaches are willing to have in a public press conference setting. Right. So you guys just like might have to be patient with me on that one, but it is something right. I'm very interested in, or at least giving you the real answers. And not what they're supposed to say or not supposed to say. I just think that that's going to be interesting to track. I think that if you're a coach and you're not looking at these things, not as an end-all be-all, but as a tool to add to the tool chest, like it's the same to me as, you know, leveraging some play action for a quarterback or, you know, your ability to run play action out of shotgun versus only under center. It's adding little edges and little advantages to your repertoire so that you can pull them out at the right time in the game and leverage them as an advantage against an opponent in the right situation. It's not about like I'm blindly following what this graph tells me.
Right.
It's about understanding the what it's telling you and how you can apply it situationally And I think that, you know, you're seeing more and more coaches take to this and do this. And I wonder, that is my legitimate question, because we know how advanced the Rams are in other areas. I wonder how clamped down they still kind of are in this space, you know?
Yeah, it is super interesting. But yeah, just this, the contrast of those two decisions. But you're right. Well, as you were talking, Jordan, I was looking at my notes there and I saw, oh, there's a few plays earlier I had written the 9RT index finger. So Sean McVay, again, well, Seattle did call a timeout, so he didn't have to make that decision in a couple seconds. But he probably looked at it perhaps and said, oh, you know, my left tackle just got blown up here and cost us a 1 yard loss. My quarterback currently has 4 functioning digits on his right hand. I don't really want to go into halftime with 0 points, so maybe I'll just take the 3 here and go in. So yeah, I guess if that factors in a little bit, I would understand it. I guess, Jordan, I was probably, given the context of all the things that we say here, I was probably more surprised that he went for it the first time from the 23,
like
that to me was a more, when we talk about Sean McVay and his decision making, that was a more interesting one to me, that he would choose to go for it there. So of course that drive ends with a Matt Gay field goal, and of course we cannot end this podcast without staying on brand and talking about wow. I mean, Jordan, there were a couple times there where it was like, uh-oh, is that missed extra point going to come back to haunt them? And then he sends 2 kickoffs out of bounds. Have we even seen that from him once?
We have seen a kickoff go out of bounds from him. The doink plus the 2 out of bound kickoffs. We've also seen him short some. Remember, we've seen him short those touchbacks. Yeah, and then he redeems himself in the eyes of Sean McVay at the very end, because it was real shaky ground there. They were going to pull a Lane Kiffin on him at the terminal, and
oh boy!
And I know reference is near and dear to your heart, Rich.
Yeah, of course.
Bringing back some old wounds for
Speaking
you.
Speaking of things that happened at 4 a.m.
And I feel like. That was shaky ground there for a minute. I mean, they love Matt Gay. Matt Gay really fits in seamlessly with the team and everything. So it's almost like they're kind of just grinding their teeth if he misses or is inaccurate in some ways, because they're just like, oh, we really like this guy. We feel like we want to have found our kicker. Gosh, dang it. And and then, you know, he kind of redeems himself at the end, and Sean McVay like went out of his way at his press conference to talk about how Matt Gay redeemed himself essentially with that last field goal to sort of ice the game away. And then also to sort of put out there that Matt knows he needs to be better and all of this stuff. So, but man, that was tenuous ground for a minute there. Whew. I thought I'd seen every weird situation. We saw a Tutu Atwell kickoff return fumble.
Yeah.
He tripped. Landed chest down on the ball, and the contact squirted the ball out and out of bounds. So got very lucky. Seattle didn't pick that one up. And so that was bad. At a certain point, you had Cooper Kupp back returning kickoffs and punts, which also speaks very poorly of your viable returners on the roster. Like, I'm trying to tell you guys, it is not their first choice that Cooper Kupp is returning punts and kickoffs. It's a have to at times. And a pretty crappy one at times, I think, too. I'm not saying Cooper is bad at it at all. I'm saying that you just don't want to open somebody up to that, especially how physically he plays the game in the run in the passing game. Totally threw his body on the line to block Jamal Adams. Kind of saw a role reversal, to go back to your point about Robert Woods, just to bring this up really quick. Is like you saw Cooper really get after it in blocking in the pass game as well before those last couple drives where they sort of opened it up with him. And you saw him sort of just throw himself in the way of Jamal Adams, at least on one time that I saw on a clip that was kind of getting shared around in order to help spring other things loose. But yeah, poorly reflective of their confidence in their other returners if you're seeing that happen. So that's still very much a work in progress. And then Seattle, you know, there's a missed field goal, or excuse me, a missed PAT by Seattle. And then you see the, I don't even know what to call it, the double punt Is that what, I mean?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I was just going to say, the person I felt sorry even more than Russell Wilson or Matthew Stafford in that game, poor Jameer Jones.
I know.
It makes a great play, and it you saw it, and I saw it, and all of our listeners saw it, but according to the stat sheet, it never happened. Jameer Jones did not even get credit for a blocked punt on that. So because Michael Dixon is able to pick up the ball. I mean, Michael Dixon made a remarkable. He's got to be the most athletic punter I've ever to pick up that ball and have the sense to give himself some space and kick it again. Yeah, we don't need to spend the Rams. I can tell you were very upset about the way that this played out. And understandably so, by the way, because that that field flipped. They would have had the ball, I think, inside the 20-yard line, maybe even inside the 15 of Seattle, and ended up being completely flipped the other way, and Seattle ends up scoring and making it a tight game. That easily could have had an impact on the game. Just real quick, yeah, what happened there is that's actually a legal play for anyone who doesn't know, as long as the punter stays behind the line of scrimmage, and that was a very... there was a flag thrown on that play, by the way, and it got picked up. So somebody looked at that initially and knew the rule. The broadcasters initially were kind of, you know, taking the officials to task. And actually, I kind of did on Twitter, too, thinking like, oh, they don't understand the rule. Well, I think they did understand the rule. They threw the flag knowing or believing that he was across the line of scrimmage. And then I don't know what conversation took place or what have you, but they decided to pick it up. And then the other part of it was that I was told that, because at one point on the broadcast, they actually showed Sean McVay with the flag in his hand. So I was told that he was told that they looked at it up in the booth. So honestly, Jordan, if it's me, I would have thrown the flag just if nothing else to like, slow things down and be like, hey, wait a second, guys. Like, let's talk about this.
And I don't think he could, though, because they had sent it to New York already. Yeah. So it would kind of be like, well, unless they come out and contradict themselves, what they had just like publicly ruled. And I think him being told that, it's almost like, well, you're going to just take out somebody's like choice and ability to do that. Like, you're just going to take out. You're going to remove that. And so for me, that's where I would also be mad, where it's like, well, I still don't believe you're right in this. So yeah, I'm going to challenge it. But then them telling him like, no, it's just you're just going to waste your time on it instead of like, maybe we should take a closer look on that one. And, and then it was like, they were furious. So I don't know if a lot of people know, like, team officials, players and coaches, this is the, like, I suppose I understand why it exists, but I cannot imagine how frustrating this would be. Team officials and players are not allowed to publicly criticize officials. Otherwise, they get a hefty fine.
Oh, yeah.
And so you have to be really careful. Like, you can ask him about it, but you have to be really careful in how you respond in this way. And so Sean was, like, very dry in responding to it in his press conference and was just like, I don't even have the brain power to explain that. And then went on to sort of rant about it for a minute.
Right.
And then, like, you know, people throughout the building were just pissed, and that's, you know, reasonable, because it just was of course. And players were like, what the hell. Jameer Jones, I felt bad for him. Not only is he just he's just erased, it's honestly, it's punt block erasure, and I'm angry about it. And and I think it also, this man all already has to suffer the indignity. The Seahawks don't even have him on the flip card up in the press box.
Oh, man.
Like, he's not on the – he's wearing the former Steven Wortel, the long snapper who lost the long snapping battle in training camp. He's wearing Steven Wortel's jersey.
Right.
I mean, give this man a break. Like, he made an excellent play. I'm standing against punt block erasure. I thought that was a phenomenal play.
If there's one thing that Jordan Rodrigue will not stand for, it is punt block erasure. That's one thing we know. Wild game. Jordan, you covered it so well on The Pile at theathletic.com and on our app. Jordan, I hope you get a couple days to relax.
I'm just ready to sleep, man. I'm ready.
You'll be researching some story and you'll be doing interviews. I know how you are. So look forward to that. Rams fans, you can relax this weekend. You can enjoy watching some football. It'll be on like all day Sunday with the London game and then the two afternoon games and the night game. Just gorge yourself on football and you don't have to worry about whether the Rams are going to win or lose. So I know Jordan will be all over it leading up to what should be an interesting game the following week in New York or in New Jersey, I guess. So Jordan, our good friends, we thank our subscribers who have been with us for so long, but we know there's some out there.
All the downs.
All the ups and all the downs. But we know there's some out there who might be on the fence. And as our good friend Isaac knows, that if you go to theathletic.com/11personnel, you can always, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can sign up there to get Jordan's great coverage. And if you do so, you get Jordan's favorite thing in the entire world, which is what?
A great discount, you guys. You get a great discount every time you go to the 11 Personnel Podcast page and you sign up for The Athletic through the 11 Personnel Podcast. You get my favorite thing in the world every single time, a great stinking discount. Very, very excited to continue on this journey with you guys. We hope you're taking care of each other. We hope you're taking care of yourselves. We hope you're leaving us 5-star reviews. We hope you're sitting on planes and telling people about us, you know?
That's right.
Really, really, really appreciate all of the support, all the love. Really appreciate all the people who tweeted at me last night to tighten the tart. Very excited to see that thing still has legs, as wobbly as they might be.
Yes.
It's still got legs. Appreciate that, you guys. We'll be back. We got 2 episodes this week, so we'll be a little bit longer without an episode unless something crazy happens, which this time of the year you probably hope that nothing crazy happens. Next time we catch you, it'll be after the New York Giants game in New Jersey. So you guys make sure to follow along with me at Jordan Rodriguez on Twitter at @RichHammond, @Rich_Hammond. And always, we appreciate you. We thank you for being with us, and we're looking forward to next time.